Welcome everyone to another podcast of Modern World Zen. This is Josh Barzell. So last episode we were talking about how we can listen to Freud and find out from Freud that really a lot of what we're doing as it pertains to religion and the divine can be classified in a psychoanalytic setting as an illusion. But this is really for neurotics, right? This is for people who are suffering, that we would classify their understandings of religion and belief as illusions. And we talked about what the true nature of God is in the Satchitananda, being consciousness and bliss. And in this episode, we're going to go a little bit further. We're going to continue to bring Freud along because really that's our best tool for, the Western thought. That's going to be our main model for Western thought as we kind of merge in this Eastern thought to it. And so in this episode, then, what we're going to focus on, trying to, attain enlightenment. So we come from the Freudian viewpoint, and we want to try to attain enlightenment. We want to try to attain this Satchitananda. We want to be Satchitananda. We want to perceive and have the experience of consciousness everywhere. We want to be really, truly happy. So when we understand that the mind, how important the mind is, certainly you can look at Freud and how he looked at the mind, which is a very beautiful way of looking at it. We can see that the mind really is the source of everything. And in the East, this is also said. In fact, the religion of the East is very similar to Freudian analysis, because the religion of the East is really the philosophy of the mind, in a sense, the way we can make the mind still and calm. And so you find very similar things being talked about. We talked about a little bit of versus the how we can talk about the true divine self and the superego and looking at the difference between the two. But really, the philosophy of the East is all about the mind, just as much as Freud talks about the mind. So we can accept, based on that, that the Western and the Eastern are really saying the same thing. We should accept that the mind really is the cause of anything that we would do. The mind would be the cause of our sorrow. The mind would be the cause of our enlightenment, right? And so we really place a very high importance to the mind. We recognize the mind is really the source of whatever it is that we're going to try to attain. And really what we're searching for is happiness. All of us are searching for happiness. We're not searching for misery or sorrow. And the mind is going to be of the utmost importance in our search for happiness. So we have to first look, once we understand the significance of the mind, we're going to really try to figure out something that we can kind of do first, which comes naturally, and that is to honor the mind. And when you do that, actually the mind becomes cleaner. So just think of the mind in a high way is actually to do therapy on it. And if that's all you do, that can be a great thing to spend time doing and just to honor the mind in that way. So really, we don't even have to concern ourselves with God or anything like that. If we just have a very high viewpoint of the mind, then we recognize that everything that comes from the mind should be honored as well. And in that way, when you do that, actually the mind doesn't become out of control. It actually sort of becomes subdued in a way once you honor it. Just as if you had a guest in your home and you honored him or her, they would become calm and peaceful and happy with the respect that they were given, where they would be upset maybe if they weren't welcomed with respect, or any place in a coffee shop or theater or anything where someone comes in as a guest or a doctor's office or temple and they're not honored, they could become agitated, right? But if they're honored and they're given a seat and they're, treated with respect, they become happy, right? So it's the same way with our mind. That's how we should treat our mind. And when we do that, it actually becomes very calm. So we can also accept that the mind is a part of God too, because nothing can exist without God. So the mind is actually a part of consciousness. And that we really shouldn't try to actively subdue the mind's creations, because we'll never be able to figure it out or help ourselves in that way. The mind's actually too strong for us to try to do that. So we can start by honoring the mind and then seeing the mind as a part of consciousness. And then try to direct the mind inward, towards the inner self, towards consciousness. And that's kind of the way we meditate. And that's kind of the goal of what we're looking at. So once we see that, even our sleep is sort of determined by the mind, certainly the dreams we have are creations of the mind. Deep sleep, is where the mind finds its deepest rest. In the same way, when we meditate and turn the mind within, we also get a lot of rest in our meditation, and that's what we should try to do. So then what happens is the mind becomes consciousness, as we've said, and we see the mind now as consciousness. And when you do that, then that's really the knowledge that we're looking for in the path of meditation. We're actually looking for the mind to be consciousness for us, and not to exist as a separate entity that causes trouble. Because really, to see the mind as consciousness is to really to honor the mind from the highest way possible. So seeing the mind as consciousness is really worshiping the mind. And it's actually really what the scriptures say. Because what the scriptures say is that the mind is nothing but a contracted form of consciousness. So really, the mind is consciousness if you look at it. And when the universal consciousness contracts, you get the mind. And so the mind really, in its true form, is just consciousness. And that's what we should be focused on. So really, then we actually can meditate on consciousness. It becomes very easy to do that, and invite everyone to do that. And so that's one way of finding absorption in consciousness, is through dealing with the mind and understanding the mind. And what I've kind of realized from a lot of what I've read about Freud, and I'm not a psychoanalyst, but Freud is primarily interested in the Oedipus complex. He first finds this Oedipus complex from the unconscious, where it's stored. And the Oedipus complex is something that can cause a lot of trouble. And if we look at it, we see that at some point, the child was, in a sense, sexualized. But you don't really have to sexualize the child too much, because after all, we are all sexual beings, and that the sexualness starts as soon as we're born. Because after all, if you understand us from the point of view of being animals, we're here to reproduce. We wouldn't be here. None of us would be here if there wasn't something that happened to make us want to procreate. And there's nothing that really needs to occur. It's just the natural force of the erotic force causes, the reproduction to occur. It's just very natural in man, but there can be an over-sexualizing of the child when he or she is young. And this is due to the idea of the Oedipus complex of sexual of the boy sexualizing the mother, and also the daughter also sexualizes the father. And in that way, what you find is a lot of things can develop. Obviously, the boy's aim in life isn't to have sex with his mother, or the girl to have sex with her father, but eventually the conclusion of the Oedipus complex, or the resolution of it, is one that brings the sort of cessation of any sort of neurotic impulses that one would have. And Freud developed, psychoanalysis with this central model of the Oedipus complex that's also in females and also in men. And I've been thinking about this myself. And from what I understand, the Oedipus complex could foreseeably be inherited in a sense, and that the truly healthy child would never really be bothered by the Oedipus complex. If it's true that the mother wasn't essentially sexualizing the child, and the way I think this possibly could occur is through this idea of the penis envy that we know that exists in young girls through a period. But if the young girl never really overcame her penis envy, and had children, the way I look at it is that the child could, for the mother, be the sort of her external genitalia in her mind. In other words, the woman who gives birth doesn't have a penis, right? But the child comes out, and that's her sort of expression of her endowment, if you will, as her sort of penis, whatever is the child, male or female or whatever that she gives birth to. So, because we know that the man has his penis, the woman does not. And this is something that the young girl really wonders about. So does the young boy wonders why he has a penis and why a girl doesn't. And this sort of leads to this fear of castration. He's just like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna end up becoming like this girl from the father's influence of the son wanting to be with his mother. The father, the fear of the boy is that the father castrates the boy, and then the boy becomes like the girl. So without getting too far into it, my idea is sort of this, and what I've been thinking about is the idea that if when the mother gives birth to the child and she doesn't have a sort of a resolved penis envy, the child becomes sort of the father's penis in a sense to the mother. It's sort of her, it's her penis, and it's also in a sense she recognizes it is as a as an external organ to her. The baby is the external organ, the sexual organ of the mother. And this implicit sexualization of the child, instead of it just being a child, it becomes sort of an extension of the mother as her own sort of penis, what she wasn't given at her birth. And I think through that objectification, if you will, of the child internalizes that. And I believe that because of that internalization, whether male or female, the Oedipus complex then is developed, where the child wouldn't necessarily have a very strong attraction to the mother unless he was sort of converted in a way by the mother's projection. So then I believe that's how the Oedipus complex even begins, is that it begins through this projection from the mother onto the child, the baby, and this internalizes into the baby's mind. And I'm not sure how that process occurs, but that's just my idea. And then it becomes a focal point for the child, where the child would never even think of something like that. And that begins the competition with the father and the wanting to be close to the mother for the boy. And it's sort of the same process for the girl. But my idea is, if the woman never really had a complex of a penis envy, when she gives birth, she just gives birth to a child, and the child is the child, and she's her, and there's no sort of mixture of these appendages. There's an allowance for the child to be an individual, even at birth, without having this sort of like hangover from the mother's own penis envy. And so I believe that if the mother was not, subject to these feelings of penis envy, when the child is born, the mother wouldn't really construct the Oedipus complex for the young boy. And so that's just my idea from reading a lot of Freud. And I would love some feedback on it if you're interested in providing it. But that certainly could be a possibility, that how this complex even begins in the child. And it may not have any effect. It might just be that even without that, regardless of that, the child, because he's so sexual, will still have an interest in the mother from an early age, through the oral phase, through the anal phase, through the phallic phase of his development. And same kind of thing. And it's analogous kind of with the female, but obviously it's changed a little bit. So I think there's two forces going on. I think part of it is due to the child's sexual development, just natural as Freud has determined it, but it might also be influenced by the mother's sort of objectification of the child as a sexual entity for the mother. And that would explain some of the mother's instinctual, if not neurotic, in this case, fear of the child being injured or hurt, because that's sort of the mother's own castration complex as it pertains to her children. Not only does she want to protect them, but she has maybe a neurotic idea that they're going to be somehow taken from her, in the sense that she would lose her own, penis, in a sense. The castration of her would be the sort of the injury, or the removal of the children, or the death of the child. And so there could be an extra strong, unhealthy attachment to the child based on the mother's unconscious penis envy, that obviously could intensify the Oedipus complex in a child and make it really, really, really a strong idea, both because of the child's own natural sexual drive, but then also a further piece added by the objectification of the child from the mother, that the child internalizes as part of along the path of his or her own development. So hopefully everyone can understand that message. It's a little bit, beyond the scope of what we normally have been doing, but I thought that, we get increasingly more deep in our analysis here in these podcasts. But it's something that I'm probably going to write up and present, this idea. I'm not a psychoanalyst, so it should be interesting to do this idea. But, again, I'm proposing that nothing Freud has said is wrong. It's just that I wonder if we could look at the cases where the mother has an unresolved, a neurotic mother gives birth to these children, and does that somehow make the Oedipus complex something that, it is much harder to deal with normally, in the child's development, if the mother somehow then passes on a sexualized idea to children. But again, they would be already sexualized. It's not as if they would sexualize the mother. Like Freud says, they would still do that. But I wonder what this extra piece could do to that child, to the normal, healthy child in his or her development. So with that, I will leave you. I thank everyone for tuning in, and we'll be doing more things in the future. But for now, this has been Josh Barzell for Modern World Zen.